This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Welcome along to the only place that brings you up-to-date exclusive coverage from all the action live in Russia as the tournament just gets underway. And what? Oh, of course. Sorry, I've got it wrong. I've got World Cup on the brain, haven't I? This is the place for exclusive coverage of the amazing things in the universe. It's a brand new episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Yes, thank you for giving us a listen. My name is Dan. We are talking about the World Cup in just a sec, though, looking at how you make footballs, and we'll find out one of the most deadly creatures around the tournament in today's Dangerous Dan. And we'll chat to an animal expert about how some beasts in the wild love a treat just like you. First, let's catch up with one of our favourite inventors at Fun Kids, Sir Sidney McSprocket, who is having a look at some of the things that you use every day and how they're made.
How's it made?
Oh, hello, Sir Sidney McSprocket here. I've been in action capturing facts all about manufacturing. It's for this rather splendid stipendiary compendium I'm compiling. You just ask it how something is made, and it'll oblige with a fulsome explanation. I bet you've kicked a football or two. Maybe you've scored a goal. When you're watching a big match on the telly, have you ever wondered how they put those balls together? Well, let's find out. Now, the footballs used in the Premier League may look fairly simple. After all, they're just a ball. But a lot of hard work goes into making sure each one does its job perfectly with no foul-ups.
Step one.
The material used to make a football is made of several layers. The top layer is a foam coated in polyurethane. This is a smooth material which stops the ball getting scuffed.
Step two.
This layer is then glued to a fabric which provides the strength. Rollers are used to press these layers together so they won't come apart.
Step three.
You may have noticed that a football is made up of lots of many-sided shapes. 20 hexagons and 12 pentagons will be punched out of the material and grouped together to be sent to the stitchers.
Step four.
These shapes are then stitched by hand. It takes 3 hours to complete one ball. Then it's ready to have its valve added. That's the little hole where you pump it up.
Step five.
Once pumped up, the ball is thoroughly checked. They must be within 5 millimeters of 64 centimeters in diameter and weigh between 425 and 445 grams. And undergo tests to make sure they can withstand heat, pressure, water, oh, and of course, a lot of kicking.
Step six.
Only the balls which meet the tough standards will reach the pitch. Meaning that if you don't shoot that goal, well, you can't blame the ball. New technology is being developed to use fewer pieces and use glue instead of stitching. But it's a manufacturing process that is taken very seriously. Almost as seriously as the game itself. Now, I must get on, but come back soon and find out more about manufacturing with my splendid stipendiary compendium.
How's it made? With support from the Royal Commission for the 1851 exhibition. Find out more at funkidslive.com.
There are loads more episodes from Sir Sidney McSprocket explaining how the things you use every single day are made, and you can download them all. Get on your phone or tablet, open up the free Fun Kids app, go to wherever you get your podcasts from, or you can always listen at funkidslive.com. We've got an animal expert on the show in just a sec, talking about which creatures love a treat just as much as you. Now, before we get them on, I want to remind you, if you've got a sciencey question, a little problem that's niggling around at your brain, maybe something you were told at school, in class, by a teacher, and it was just so astounding, you thought, how can that possibly be true? Or maybe one of your mates that's known to fib a little bit told you something in the playground and swore it was true, but you don't believe a word of it. Well, you can double check just in case. Ask me your sciencey question and I will get an expert on this show to answer it for you. The best way is to leave it as a review on the iTunes podcast store. So open that up, find the Fun Kids Science Weekly, drop 5 stars, leave me your name so I know who you are. Then in the little comment box at the bottom, ask me your science question. Then I will have a look, I will find it, and I'll try and get an expert on to answer it for you. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, I saw something online the other day about the dwarf mongoose and how they've got a brilliant way of rewarding their good behaviour. So I thought I'd call up an expert to tell us more. Professor Andy Radford is from the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Bristol. He's on the show. Andy, hello.
Hello.
So I thought we'd start with just a little bit about the dwarf mongoose, really. They're not a creature that everyone knows too much about. So can you tell us more?
Yes, so they're Africa's smallest carnivore. If a dwarf mongoose stands up on its hind legs, it's about the size of a 500 milliliter bottle of water. So really quite a small creature. And it's the small cousin of the much more famous meerkat that everybody knows about. And just like meerkats, the dwarf mongooses live in social groups made up of some family members, but also some other individuals from further afield. And they're usually in groups of maybe 5 to 20 individuals who spend all their time together doing a whole bunch of different activities and generally living together.
Now, you say they're a carnivore, but they're tiny. So what are they feasting on that's possibly smaller than them?
So they're spending a lot of time fossicking through the sort of loose vegetation on the ground, looking for invertebrates or small reptiles. So occasionally they're quite good at catching snakes, for example. They also sometimes get things like giant land snails, which they can crack open. So they have a variety of things that they feed on, but obviously very small creatures, generally speaking.
And what's their main selling point? What's their main pro in terms of hunting and not being hunted? For instance, if this was like a Pokemon card, what would their like attack strength be?
Well, in terms of attacking things, when they're foraging by themselves, they really don't team up. They're just looking for things individually. But if they encounter something nasty like a poisonous snake, a cobra, for example, then they recruit one another with these special calls so that they can come and mob it collectively, which means that their kind of combined force is enough to see away that danger. But what they also do generally, which I would say is kind of one of their main features, is that while they're foraging, one of the group adopts a raised position and acts as what we call a sentinel. So it dedicates itself to looking out for danger while the rest of the group are foraging on the ground. And that sentinel, if it spots danger, warns the foragers with a series of alarm calls so they can focus on the foraging while someone else is doing the vigilance for them.
Now, is this like allotted? Is there almost a work schedule that says, right, today you're the sentinel, or do they play it by ear and they've got a way of communicating who's the best person to be at that particular moment?
Yeah, it's a great question. So everybody, or at least all the adults, contribute to being a sentinel on some occasions. So it's not just a few select specialists, but everybody does the task. But you don't get a strict rota. And there's variability in who contributes the most. And one of the things that's likely to be important is it's to do with how full you are from your foraging. So if you've been feeding well and you're quite satiated, then you're more likely to go on sentinel duty because while you're doing that, you can't actually forage. So you really only tend to do it if you're already full from feeding.
Now, we're talking about sentinels. You've produced research over the last few weeks that's found out something quite incredible about how they reward each other for being sentinels, because it doesn't go unnoticed, does it, Andy?
No, that's right. So when a sentinel is acting as that raised guard, it's giving a little vocalization. We call it a surveillance call, which is announcing its presence to the rest of the group. So they know it's there, even if they're not looking up to check visually. And what we found is that those individuals that do more of this cooperative task, this sentinel duty, are rewarded more by other group members because they groom those sentinels more So grooming is a great reward because it both removes things like ectoparasites, but it also has social functions. It's a nice thing to receive, a bit like a massage in the case of humans. And we've known for a long time in lots of different animal species that cooperative acts can be exchanged for one another immediately. So say you did a sentinel task, you came down and were immediately rewarded with grooming. But this new work shows that that reward can actually happen for past events, things that were going on several hours before. So the mongooses are managing to track who has done these tasks, remember who's done the most, and then reward them much later on, in this case when they go back to the sleeping burrow in the evening.
So that's like if you're at school and maybe you get a few stickers in a book, and then at the end of the week if you get so many stickers you get a nice reward. What I can't quite wrap my head around though is why this is such big news in the animal kingdom. I mean, humans, we do this kind of thing all the time. Do we not see any other types of animals that exhibit this type of memory and then rewarding behaviour?
Yeah, so humans obviously do it all the time, and we're familiar with that. We're able to track contributions by others and remember them across periods of hours or even days and reward them accordingly later on. But that obviously requires a decent level of cognitive ability and memory. Now, there's been some strong evidence for similar abilities in some primate species, so things that we think of as more our closest relatives and are traditionally thought of as having these, you know, greater cognitive skills. So there have been studies showing that there can be these delayed rewards with respect to helping out in conflict situations, for example, or getting access to food. But this is the first time that anybody's shown experimentally and with a wild natural population of non-primates that this ability exists, this ability to remember past acts, to track the amount that was going on, and then to reward them accordingly at a later time.
Now, talk to me about the start of this study then, Andy, because I'm always amazed that you guys down at the University of Bristol, or really kind of smart people anywhere, decide to research this kind of thing. What pricked your ears up that the dwarf mongooses might show this sign of behaviour? And then when you think they might, how do you get on your way to finding out if they do?
Yeah, so the starting point of all of this was my co-author on this paper, Julie Kern, who just amazingly set up this population of dwarf mongooses in South Africa for our study as part of her master's back in 2011 now, so a long time ago. And the amazing thing about this study population is they're habituated to our close presence, which takes a lot of time and effort. But what it means now is that we can walk in close proximity to these wild groups in their natural setting all the time when we want to. We can mark them individually with a blonde hair dye on the end of a paintbrush. We've trained them to climb onto a balance scale to weigh themselves. And so we can get a really amazing insight into their everyday lives because they're just used to us being there. And so when you start watching them, you start seeing all sorts of things going on that perhaps you didn't expect or didn't know about before. And one of those was this sentinel behaviour and then how it might link to grooming behaviour.
Fantastic. Well, Andy, thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly to tell us more.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for your time.
It's time for this week's Dangerous Dan then, where we have a look at the most mean and evil things in the universe. Now today, because the World Cup has only just started in Russia, I thought we'd head over there and take a look at one of the scariest things that they've got. It's the Karakurt spider, also known as the European Black Widow. Now, its poison is notorious. It can kill a person in just a few hours, and they look terrifying. Like, just for a second, try and imagine the scariest spider that you can drum up. I promise it won't be far off this. It's jet black. It's got red spots on its bulging, round abdomen. And it's awful because you know that this is meant to look enticing and attractive, just so they can sucker prey in and then kill it. When they bite, the poison seeps through their body, causing nausea, weakness, numbness, fever. And they're not just mean to humans either, but to themselves and their offspring. When the mother lays baby Karakurt eggs, she never visits them. just leaves them to hatch in the nest and for them to grow up and make their own way in the world. That is the deadly, terrifying Karaka spider, one of the most dangerous animals in Russia, where the World Cup is. Still, come on, England, you know, three lines in the shirt on all that. You're listening to the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, we'll find out why almost a quarter of British mammals are at risk of vanishing in just a sec. First, let's take a trip into space and go to one of the smartest schools in the solar system. It's Deep Space High, and this is all about the Vomit Comet.
Deep Space High, the Universe Handbook with the Science and Technology Facilities Council.
Quieten down, you lot. Today, we're in the space lab to work on the next chapter in our universe handbook. It's all about how to prepare yourself for space exploration.
What? You mean like making sure you've got the right moon boots and a packed lunch?
Not preparing your lunch, Alex. Preparing your body. I mean, astronaut training, Earth style.
Oh, Earth astronauts are light years behind most of the galaxy. A bunch of space chimps could manage their training.
We all have to start somewhere, and Earth astronauts are as tough as they come. They have to be, as their technology isn't as advanced as it is here at Deep Space High. So, come on, zip up your space suits. Astronaut training starts here.
Astronaut training starts in a swimming pool?
That's right. Everyone in.
Water is a great place for astronauts to get used to the feeling of being nearly weightless. It's a feeling they have to get used to in space. They train in special pools called neutral buoyancy pools and practice everything from spacewalks to making snacks. Have a try just walking about. Go on.
It's quite hard to move around underwater. Nothing quite goes where you want it to. It must take them ages to get anything done.
It does take some getting used to. Let's get up to the surface.
You can take your helmets off, but before we get out, I want you all to swim one length in your space suits.
You're joking! They're so heavy! Can't we take the boots off at least?
No chance. Astronauts have to be super physically fit. They have to be able to swim at least three lengths of a large pool like this with all their equipment, including their boots. Aww. Oh, OK. Seeing as how I'm in a good mood, I'll zap us all onto dry land. End the programme, computer. Load up astronaut training, phase two.
Well, we're on dry land. Looks like some sort of desert. But it's hard to see. It's pitch black.
Where are we? And what does a desert have to do with space? I think it's a bit scary out here. I don't like it at all.
Keep your voices down. Another part of astronaut training is wilderness survival. Astronauts have to be not only physically tough, but mentally tough too. Surviving in unfamiliar surroundings, like here, in the middle of a desert at night. No maps, no food. How long do you think we'd survive?
But come on, sir. Come on, sir. You're not going to meet a wolf in space, are you?
It's more about being brave and resourceful. You only get one crack at space missions. Things can go wrong, and do. And if technology lets you down, can be up to the astronaut to come up with a solution. Right, there's just one more stop on our astronaut training journey. Computer, load up the Vomit Comet.
Cool, we're on a massive plane.
Not just any plane. This one flies to a high altitude and then goes up and down in parabolic arcs to give the astronauts a taste of real weightlessness. Hold on, we're going up.
Whoa, I can really feel gravity pulling us back. Must be a bit like a real takeoff. And hey, look, now we're floating.
Brilliant! Woohoo! Look, I'm doing a cartwheel!
Make the most of it. Weightlessness lasts about 20 seconds. Then, as the plane descends sharply, gravity will kick in again. Here we go.
Whoa!
It's like being on a roller coaster.
I think I feel a bit sick.
How many times would an astronaut have to go up and down?
Oh, only a few hundred times. That's why it's called the Vomit Comet. Computer, end training. That's all for today. Don't forget your homework. Just like Earth astronauts, you'll need to swat up on astronomy, physics, mathematics, geology, meteorology and aeronautics too. Earth astronauts have to have brains as well as brawn.
OK, maybe they are pretty cool. Not chimps at all.
Deep Space High, the Universe Handbook with the Science and Technology Facilities Council.
Let's do this week's Science in the News then, talking about the big stories that have captured my eye and blown my mind. Not good news to start either, because one of five British mammals is at risk of extinction. This comes as results of a study by the Mammal Society, which has said that factors like climate change, loss of home and disease are to blame for 20% of British mammals being close to dying out. That means we might lose species like the red squirrel, the wildcat and the grey long-eared bat. Also, a raccoon has been dubbed a daredevil after it climbed 23 floors of a huge building in a day. Now, for some reason, the raccoon started climbing, no one knows why, but it got higher and higher and higher up the building and everyone became transfixed with it as it got more and more daring until finally at 3 o'clock in the morning, it arrived at the roof, at the top, and found some cat food as a reward as rescues found it. And finally, a tree called an icon of the African savannah is dying in mysterious circumstances. The largest and oldest African baobab tree has mostly died over the last 12 years. Now, normally it can live to thousands of years, but this one is dying. And researchers haven't a clue why, saying they've never seen an event of this magnitude before. Now, before we return back to Earth after our quick weekly zoom round the universe, there's time to squeeze in another brutal beast battle on the Fun Kid Science Weekly. This is our man versus animal challenge. We've done wrestling before, strength, speed. This week, it's who gets to save cash on glasses.
Extreme Athlete Challenge with the Society of Biology.
You join us just as the competition is about to begin. We're pitting man against animal once again in our Extreme Athlete Challenge. Today we're seeing who has the keenest eyesight, and the first to compete is Russian Viktor Ruban, who took gold in archery at the Beijing Olympics in 2008. And representing the animal kingdom, we have a hawk.
One of the deadliest birds of prey and a common sight in our countryside.
Victor will be the first to compete. He's putting the arrow in the bow and he's taking aim at a target an astonishing 70 metres away. Can he seat an arrow in the centre from this distance?
He's drawing the bow. The centre of the target is just 12 centimetres wide. Amazing! He's got it right in the bullseye. Incredible!
Now it's the turn of the hawk.
He's hovering over fields to find something to eat. And even though he's 20 metres in the air, it looks like he's seen something.
Amazing! He's caught a mouse, even though it was hidden in the grasses.
The hawk has the ability to sense not just objects, but movement at much greater levels than humans.
In fact, with sight of a five times sharper than a human's, he's a clear winner, our extreme athlete of the day.
Let's hear it for the hawk.
Extreme Athlete Challenge with the Society of Biology.
An Extreme Athlete Challenge finishes off this episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. And now, if you've got a question, remember something sciencey that you want an expert to answer. You can leave it as a review on the iTunes podcast store. I will see it and I'll get the perfect expert on the show to answer it for you. Also, while you're on the iTunes podcast store, you can find all our brilliant science series on there. They're also on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com. And you can listen to Fun Kids all over the country on your DAB digital radio on that free Fun Kids app. And as always, at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.